You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining us today, we have Nathan Gilmore, professor of English at Emmanuel College in Franklin Springs, Georgia. Nathan, did I get that all right?
Yep, everything's good so far.
Awesome. Also joining us, Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. Jordan, how are you doing this morning?
Good. I'm good. I'm also tired and ornery because of all the stuff that I read for this.
So, yeah.
And I almost didn't unmute myself, so that's the kind of morning I'm having.
Fair enough. A new guest on the show, Sam Arora, businessman and attorney, currently living in, are you still living in Silver Spring, Maryland, Sam, or are you?
No, I'm in Washington, D.C. now.
All right, down in Washington, D.C., he served as a Maryland state representative, actually as my Maryland state representative, although I did not vote for you. I also didn't vote against you. I think I voted in Wyoming absentee that year, so it wasn't a shot against you. Prior to his service as a representative, he was a campaign aide to several Democratic campaigns, including Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. And Sam, you don't have to answer this, but I do want to ask: did you work for a campaign this year? And if so, who was it?
No. I'm fully employed and a father and a husband now, so I'm not on a campaign currently.
Okay, so. Well, maybe you don't have to answer this either. If you could have worked on a campaign for a Democrat this year, which one of the 16, and why Marianne Robinson?
right, fair enough. I was really pleased to see my friend Pete Buttigieg put on such a strong effort. I've not been a spear thrower for a long time. It is nice to see a good debate about ideas. But in the spirit of today's theme, I'm going to decline to express an idea for fear that it might limit my future opportunities.
That's fair. That's fair. Well, we should get into the topic. We were talking about the letter on open justice and open debate, not open justice and debate. Letter on justice and open debate that was published on July 7th in Harper's Magazine, and then signed by multiple people. We'll get to the text of the letter in a minute, but first, Nathan, can you walk us through? Just give us a brief overview of who signed, the sorts of people who signed, who is this letter from?
All right, so this is a letter, an open letter in Harper's Magazine. If you're not familiar, listeners, with that magazine, I mean, it's a pretty reliably liberal publication. It's one that, was a very strong and outspoken critic of the George W. Bush administration. That's when I was a subscriber to the magazine. I let it lapse, not because of any personal issues, but just because I got so busy I didn't have time to read it anymore. The signatories here, are folks who, have over the last several years, shown some concern about, a new illiberalism that often gets called cancel culture. Folks that you would expect, people who kind of shuttle back and forth between Democrat and Republican circles, David Brooks, David Frum, Jonathan Haidt, Steven Pinker. J.K. Rowling signed it, which is not surprising given the controversy that she's been embroiled in recently. We're going to talk about that in some detail here in a bit. Salman Rushdie, I was glad to see his name hit there because in my lifetime, he was kind of the OG of free speech. He got a real fatwa put out on him for his novel Satanic Verses, which, is one of those novels along with Last Temptation of Christ that I think people got offended at the wrong passages. They got all, bothered about the sex parts when actually the theological parts were the real offensive parts. These weren't the only folks who signed this letter, though. Some pleasant surprises. John McWhorter, who's a Columbia linguistics professor and the host of the Lexicon Valley podcast. He's one who is, pretty reliably and pretty consistently anti-Trump, but signed this letter. And incidentally, I found out recently also wrote a pretty scathing review of the book White Fragility here recently. Yeah. Wynton Marsalis, I was also pleasantly surprised to see on there because I listened to his jazz records. I don't think of him as a political figure really at all, so I was pleased to see him on there. And then some people, I mean, who I frankly, you know, was surprised to see just because I think of them as part of the resistance. You know, I mean, Noam Chomsky, who, I mean, his sympathies for things Soviet is no, I mean, it's not even an open secret. It's just kind of open. So, I mean, you know, the fact that he signed this, I mean, surprised me pleasantly. You know, Gloria Steinem, who really shouldn't have surprised me, but did a little bit just because, you know, over the last few years, I have associated, you know, public feminism to a large extent with the hashtag Me Too and the hashtag Believe Women tendencies in public life. And so those often run into, you know, tension with what I would call classical liberalism. And then Margaret Atwood, who is one of the genuine public figures in the resistance against Trump, also signed this letter, which I also found, you know, pleasantly. I've said before on other shows on the Christian Humanist Radio Network that I find her novel, The Handmaid's Tale, to be just unbearably preachy. I've never been a big fan of that novel, but I was pleased to see her on here. So it's an interesting spectrum. You know, I mean, some of the critics of this letter have called it a reactionary, you know, wealthy white male response to, you know, people who have been underrepresented standing up. I mean, hopefully, I mean, if you don't know some of these figures, you know, just do a little Google image search tour through the signatory of this letter. I mean, you've got a fair spectrum here. So, Coyle, any other figures who signed this that you want to highlight here?
Yeah, first, I want to hear from Jordan and Sam. Anyone jump out at you guys?
Well, I was interested to see Barry Weiss as a signatory to this former New York Times opinion writer, who then, I think, subsequently published her own letter on the what she saw happening at the New York Times. She said that Twitter was becoming its editor, and for that reason, or for reasons related to that, resigned.
Yeah, if you guys haven't read that, or listeners, if you haven't read that letter, it's worth picking up. I don't think I got it on the outline in time for today's episode, but it is certainly worth going over. Jordan, anyone jump out at you?
Yeah, Barry Weiss was one of the ones that I noticed, especially because I think like the day after I first read this Harper's open letter, someone sent me her open letter of resignation, and so the dovetailing of those is pretty striking. A couple of maybe, I don't want to say smaller, but maybe names that don't immediately jump out at people. Well, David Blight, who is a historian, I believe at Yale University. Martin Amis, the novelist, the son of Kingsley Amis. Martin Amis is famous for his novels, but he wrote a really, really powerful book called Coba the Dread, about Stalin and Stalinism and the complicity of Western intellectuals in the repression of not just speech, but millions of lives in Stalinist Russia, which is a very good introductory book I like to recommend to students. Anne Applebaum, who's written a whole bunch of histories of things like the Gulag and the Holodomor, her book about the Ukrainian famine, I think is her most recent. So maybe not as prominent as J.K. Rowling, but ones that I definitely noticed, as well as Matthew Iglesias, who's one of the did he help found Vox? I know he's one of the most prominent figures at Vox.
I believe he is one of the founders of Vox. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that apparently has triggered some kind of, you know, miniature Twitter Chernobyl at Vox, which has been I am trying very hard to do things that are not going to warp the timber of my soul, so I have not dug into that because I would be too tempted to gloat, and I'm prone to schadenfreude anyway, but that's going on. And two other ones, Jesse Singel, who I believe calls himself a leftist, but has written a number of times for Reason magazine, which is a very, very, you know, doctrinaire libertarian magazine, particularly digging into things that I noticed, you know, as someone who writes and publishes fiction in a very small way, looking into the kind of weird dynamic of young adult fiction Twitter, and the way it's kind of, you know, shooting its wounded and eating its dead right now, just with all kinds of his reporting on young adult literature for Reason is, it is not surprising to me to see his name on this letter as a result. And finally, the name that I am most recently acquainted with is Deirdre McCloskey, who is a, pardon me, I am still a novice at the shifting vocabulary for this. Deirdre McCloskey began life as a man, and it has transitioned, I believe, sometime in the 90s to be a woman, which I know she's written a number of times for conservative outlets like National Review, which has led to denunciations in places like First Things. But it, so there's its own kind of mini Chernobyl for you from the other direction. But, you know, this is at least one trans woman who is signing on to this thing, which is a, you know, that's probably going to be a recurrent thread of discussion as we talk about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you guys have sort of hit all of the big names. So some of the names are people that I really have a lot of respect for, and some of the names are people I've never heard of. I don't think there's anyone on there that I'm like, oh, who cares that jerk signed. But by and large, it's a kind of a who's who of academics and writers, with a few exceptions here and there. It's kind of tempting to go to, well, who's not on this list that should be? And frankly, I don't know enough about how signers for these sorts of things are drummed up to be able to really comment intelligently on that. So we'll talk about the controversy with Rowling in a minute. Stephen King got involved in that at one point, and this seems like the sort of thing that he could have signed, and yet he didn't. So either he chose not to, or just no one ever reached out to him, and there's no way to really know how that works. I do think, and we can talk more about this in a minute if you want to, and maybe I'm misreading this, but I think it's probably fair to say that this list of signers trends older. Right. This tends to be a spectrum of certainly beliefs and races and orientations and so on. But it is not a young and hip spectrum of people. Is that fair, or am I reading my own prejudices into this?
I feel like I would be last among this group to tell anyone what is hip. but I wonder. You know, I've heard there's a generational debate, where there's an older view of what free speech is utility, or the bounds of the Overton window of protected speech, what it should be, and that is changing. Small example, I don't know that this is representative, but I was going to give a talk, as I do every year, to a group of summer interns in Washington, D.C., and I styled the talk something like, "Don't waste your life." I was surprised when the talk was scheduled that it was called, "How to Make the Most Out of Your Summer." So I said, "Well, what happened? When did the title change?" And the organizers told me, "Don't waste your life" was too threatening of a title for the young folks in that cohort. That was new to me. I don't know that that's representative, but it was sort of a surprise that people need to be saved from speech.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that doesn't seem threatening at all. But maybe I'm in that older demographic. I mean, it's not like the title was "I'll punch you in the throat." I mean, maybe it should have been, and then you should have negotiated back to "Don't waste your life."
Perhaps. I think I might get tripped up by the myriad microaggressions in between. But it was interesting. I mean, for me, and I don't think that I shouldn't be so quick to conclude that their conclusions, the organizers, sure, lacked merit, but I didn't initially understand them. I still don't think I would agree with them, but it doesn't mean that that's not a valid perspective. But if that is a representative example, then that could explain why the signatories to this letter are generationally different, or separated from maybe those who are at the vanguard of the current social justice movements.
Yeah, and I want to do a quick deep dive into one of the signatories on this letter. I think probably the most eminent person on the list, at least the most well-known. J.K. Rowling, in what, a week before this letter came out, was involved in a Twitter controversy, because, you know, those are the only controversies we have these days, over all sorts of things. Jordan, can you just give us a quick overview of that, if a quick overview is possible?
Yeah, I will try to be quick. This is some, man, where to start? I'm a historian. I'll start at the beginning. So this has actually been a lot longer coming than this, you know, the immediate lead up to the open letter. I think the first real serious incident in it, although I know, you know, Rowling has courted controversy before, this is an interesting pivot for her, I think, because, you know, the original controversy surrounding Harry Potter, created by The Onion, by the way, was, of course, about Satanism. That was like the original mistaking The Onion for real news. I heard that Onion article read from the pulpit. True story. So, you know, and then at one point, you know, kind of retconning Dumbledore to be gay, that kind of thing. So, I mean, Rowling's status as kind of a, you know, therapeutically left of center, kind of like feel good liberal, I was pretty well established up to December of 2019. What I think is interesting about this controversy is the way it kind of blew apart sort of what everybody thought about her. And so you get those, you know, kind of flip floppings, you know, people who used to disagree with her now are supporting her, that kind of thing. So in December 2019, this relatively minor kind of bureaucratic kerfuffle in the UK got attention because Rowling tweeted about it. So there was a researcher, and I'm going to, again, try to summarize as much as possible here, a researcher named Maya Fortstetter, who was fired from a government job for a tweet that was deemed transphobic. I can't recall the exact text of the tweet, but it had something to do with legislation requiring a person to address a person by the, you know, the identity that they have self-declared or whatever. Actually, interestingly, similar to the controversy that brought Jordan Peterson to national or international attention.
Right.
And he was the name that I thought was most interestingly not present on Harper's, which I assume has to do with his ongoing kind of physical and family problems. So anyway, she tweeted support for Maya Fortstetter, and Rowling's tweet anyway said, "Dress however you please, call yourself whatever you like, sleep with any consenting adult who will have you, live your best life in peace and security," all of which is, of course, you know, making those small daily sacrifices to, you know, modern therapeutic liberalism. But the last line is the stinger: "But force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real." Just kind of letting that question hang. So the controversy immediately erupted around this because she's staking out a pretty clear position on, you know, the reality of biological sex as being immutable, which of course is, you know, violence and hate and blah, blah, blah. She's been labeled a TERF, which I might be getting the letter R here incorrect, but I believe that's trans exclusionary radical feminist.
That's how I've read it, Jordan, so...
Yeah, I know the – I had to look up the TE because I couldn't remember exactly what it meant, but I forgot the R. Trans-exclusionary radical feminist. That is, she is a radical feminist, but she is not radical enough because she does not extend her feminism to trans women, right? And again, this is somebody who's more well-versed in kind of the sectarian – disputation of the various branches of feminism could probably give a more learned disputation on that. But this is basically a kind of interfeminist thing, which has exploded because of a Ling's tweet of support for Maya Fortstetter. Oh, and she hashtagged it, you know, "I stand with Maya," something like that. So a very what would have lent really immense and prominent support to Fortstetter with Rowling, who has millions of Twitter followers, again, turned into this thing, or a do, as they might say in England, Vox, because Vox is Vox, immediately voxed it and said, did J.K. Rowling just destroy the legacy of Harry Potter with a single transphobic tweet? And, you know, the usual rule for rhetorical questions and headlines is no. The answer is no. But that was just Vox being Vox. But that does kind of neatly frame the explosion of controversy surrounding her Twitter thing. I was vaguely aware of that for a while. I've been off Twitter for several years and don't miss it. But, you know, that did trickle into my limited news reading. I guess it died down somewhat. But in June, Rowling published an essay on her website, which she... And we'll probably come back to this, but I've been struck by how very carefully everybody who participates in these things attempts to explain and cover for themselves and how little that actually matters. But she wrote about how difficult it was for her to, you know, approach this essay, but it was a longish essay. I thought pretty, you know, reasonable and well-reasoned. Quote, about her reasons for speaking out on sex and gender issues. She goes through five major reasons, a lot of them relating to her survival of domestic abuse, as well as being a former teacher and a bunch of the charitable activity that she is involved with, a lot of which involves things like women's prisons and stuff like that. So she's got an intense concern, especially with the violation of single-sex accommodations like a women's prison, that kind of thing. But the conclusion, which again kind of dovetails with some of what we were reading in this letter, all I'm asking, all I want, is for similar empathy, similar understanding to be extended to the many millions of women whose sole crime is wanting their concerns to be heard without receiving threats and abuse. Then I couldn't help but Coyle, you and I talked about this the other day. I couldn't help but include this BuzzFeed headline, which is just everything wrong with the world right now. People with Harry Potter tattoos are asking, what now? So,
as they do every day of their life.
Exactly. Go look up that BuzzFeed article. It's one of those things you'd have to hashtag not the onion. So, since the publication of her essay, as well as, you know, the continuing sort of fallout, to continue the Chernobyl metaphor, of her first Twitter thing back in December, I read elsewhere that, quote-unquote, several authors, don't know who those authors are, but several authors have left the literary agency that represents Rowling, which I'm sure, you know, the agency is really regretting having her and not them. And then, to their credit, her publisher, Hatchett, has stood by Rowling, and I wanted to quote their statement because, again, it... echoes, and I think is actually a better statement in some ways than the Harper's letter, but they, you know, a chunk of their statement, you know, indicating they would continue to publish Rowling's books, including one that's forthcoming. Freedom of speech is the cornerstone of publishing. We fundamentally believe that everyone has the right to express their own thoughts and beliefs. That's why we never comment on our authors' personal lives, and we respect our employees' right to hold a different view. We will never make our employees work on a book whose content they find upsetting for personal reasons, but we draw a distinction between that and refusing to work on a book because they disagree with an author's views outside their writing, which runs contrary to our belief in free speech. The flash forward a couple of weeks, and Rowling is one of the most prominent signatories to that open letter. So prominent, she's one of the few people who doesn't have some kind of institutional affiliation or profession listed by her name. She's just J.K. Rowling. Anything y'all know more about or would add to that? That's more than I really wanted to say, but it is pretty thorny.
I don't have anything. Nathan or Sam, you guys have anything to add?
Well, I'll just note that... Oh, go ahead, Sam. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Okay. It's interesting to see kind of from where this statement comes. Like, Hachette, huge publisher, whereas you see this debate happening in newspaper editorial rooms, right? Like, the New York Times has been probably the most famous as to, you know, how it's sort of, I don't know, I'll say imploded, but obviously Barry Weiss resigned, James Bennett was let go related to publication of the Tom Cotton op-ed. And it's really an open debate, like, what is debatable inside of, I wouldn't say just literature, but in newsrooms. Where is the Overton window? Are there opinion pieces that are outside of publication? And I think the answer to that is always going to be yes. Like, you're not going to allow or you're not going to accept a racial supremacy theory op-ed in the pages of the New York Times. But the question really is kind of what is that Overton window? I mean, I would ask the question, has it gotten a lot more narrow? Are the acceptable ideas for debates so more narrow now than they were, say, 5 years ago? And then I think that has got to spill over into the literary world as well, as they're determining what is worth a platform.
Yeah, and Nathan, go ahead. You had a...
Oh, all I was going to add is that, I mean, I think that Jordan's examination there dovetails nicely with what you, Coyle, were saying earlier, that this does have a generational clash character to it. The folks who are standing up for, you know, Rowling and others, you know, in this controversy tend to be folks, I mean, frankly, older than 40 and, you know, folks who are, you know, taking the side of or making the claim that, you know, this kind of speech deserves, economic threat tend to be under 40. So, I mean, I think that, you know, that theme continues to echo here. But keep rolling, man.
Anything else on the rolling background? Otherwise, I'll just say a word or two about kind of the bigger picture background, which ties into this generational thing.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say one other thing that Sam kind of adumbrated is and you even mentioned this earlier, you know, about Twitter controversies, the kind of very, very small world that all of this is taking place in. Because Sam was talking earlier about Barry Weiss's resignation and how Twitter is kind of running the editorial page at the Times now, the New York Times. And, all of these Twitter controversies, this is a teeny tiny sliver of the population. And I believe I told my wife about some of this a while back, and she was, she is plugged in and she, you know, likes J.K. Rowling and, you know, kind of keeps up with what she does, but she was totally unaware of it. So, you know, the extent to which Twitter is kind of trying to become real life, when it's really this, you know, kind of teeny tiny cesspool of people screaming at each other. I don't know. That's something that I think is also, I don't know what to do with that, but it's something that I've noticed.
Yeah, someday I want to do an episode on Twitter, but I hate it so much that I just haven't been able to bring myself to. It is a cesspool and it is small, but it's a small cesspool that is largely full of the affluent and powerful. So it's not like you have a lot of poor people out there tweeting, right? I mean, I'm sure there's some, but it kind of matters disproportionately to its numbers, which explains why it affects the New York Times in a way that it doesn't my individual life. Because I'm, you know,
right,
not on the affluent or wealthy side of things and perfectly happy there.
Right, and it's notable that it differs from Facebook in that respect, because Facebook has, I mean, close to 2 billion users. Actually, it might have gone over 2 billion users since the last time I looked at their stats. But, you know, by contrast, Twitter is tiny but punches far above its weight.
Right. And again, we should do an episode. They have kind of an interesting free speech history themselves that has been modified in the last year or so. Well, the kind of bigger background to this, our current cancel culture that this letter on justice and open debate is pushing back against, ironically starts with this older generation of people, and the kind of seminal essay on this is Herbert Marcuse's Marcuse, I can never remember how you're supposed to say that. His essay "Repressive Tolerance" comes out in the 1960s. And is fairly influential on the New Left, so it is itself an older idea. You can go back and listen to the second episode we did on communism. We get into this essay a little bit. The short version of this, and I'm not doing this justice. It's a really complicated piece, but the short version is: in a society like the modern Western society, if you really want to be tolerant, tolerance doesn't mean you just let the majority have its say all the time. Tolerance means that sometimes you need to tell the majority to shut up and actively promote minority voices. That is, you need to repress people who otherwise are going to just steamroll over everyone else, and then take that everyone else and give them a voice disproportionate in society to the strength they would otherwise have in themselves, because of their numbers or because of whatever other factors work to make them a minority. So that's sort of the short version. And that idea deserves, again, its own episode. It's a worthwhile essay. But it trickles into society such that I think both sides basically operate on that these days. So it's the rhetoric of talk radio on the right. It's the rhetoric of George W. Bush's terrorism speeches, basically all of them after September 11th. You know, you're for us or you're against us. It's certainly the activity of the tearing down of statues, right, is kind of that embodied and put to work in public life. So it's an idea that's all over the place, and it's a very old idea. Even though now in this letter, you have some of the people. I saw that Todd Gitlin was on this Todd Gitlin was one of those 60s radicals, and I think one of the most prominent of them who kind of embraced that view, now looking back and you know, being horrified by the practical application of the things that 40 years ago he was teaching. But again, I can't rag on the right too much, or on the left too much, because the right is as guilty of this in some ways as the left is. So there is a bigger picture background here. This episode isn't on Marcuse or talk radio or George W. Bush, but if you guys want to say anything about any of that, you can. Otherwise, we'll get into the text of the letter itself.
Yeah, Coyle, if I could follow up just a moment. One theorist who looks at this, you know, on a big picture level very, very well, is René Girard, the cultural studies theorist.
Right.
And, you know, a couple of his big ideas, one of them is the idea of the Christian revolution centering the scapegoat. So whereas, you know, in pagan texts and even Old Testament texts, you know, the sacrificial victim was there to be cast out and killed in order to restore order, what Christianity does is shifts the focus of attention to the scapegoat, namely Jesus, so that, you know, post Christian revolution, and of course he doesn't date that at the crucifixion, he dates it, you know, when Christianity becomes a majority culture, in a new way, it becomes advantageous to cast oneself as the scapegoat, the one who has been marginalized. And, you know, his idea is that there is a limit to that. You know, he calls it the apocalypse. He, you know, like a lot of cultural theorists, borrows theological language for, you know, sociological realities. And he says that, you know, there is theoretically some limit to that where everyone claims the status of victim for the self, and therefore, I mean, you know, basically intelligibility falls apart. So, I mean, I have thought a lot about René Girard over the last several years.
Well, I can't say that I have, but it sounds like I should be. Anything else?
I will say that he's one of those French theorists who's impossible to read, so please don't pick up his books expecting easy prose. Because he doesn't write that.
Yeah, that's the hallmark of 20th century writing, I think, is be dense. Anything else? Otherwise, we'll jump into the letter. Well, the letter itself begins by please guys, feel free to interrupt here. Otherwise, I'm just going to walk over kind of the main points of the letter, and you guys jump in, and then we can talk about the whole thing as well. So it begins by acknowledging the legitimate claims of protesters, right? Things like police reform, greater equality and inclusion, especially, they say, in higher education, journalism, philanthropy, and the arts, which I will admit my thought on reading that was, yes, those are all definitely bastions of systematic racism and retrogressive opinions. I don't know. Anyway, I thought that was kind of an interesting cluster of things to target. These claims have, they say, have included a new set of moral attitudes and political commitments that tend to weaken norms of open debate and toleration and differences, toleration of differences in favor of ideological conformity. This is bad. This is a threat to democracy, just like Donald Trump. Free speech, they argue, is the lifeblood of a liberal society and is daily being constricted. They say we would expect that from the right, but now we're hearing calls for swift often severe retribution and the use of institutions to deliver hasty and disproportionate punishments instead of considered reforms. This isn't how debate in a democracy should work. It's bad for the arts. It suppresses creativity. It creates risk aversion rather than a desire to push back boundaries. And it's especially bad for the causes that are being pursued. The restriction of debate, whether by a repressive government or an intolerant society, this is a quote, invariably hurts those who lack power and makes everyone less capable of democratic participation. They end by giving a sort of libertarian idea of free speech, that is, the idea that bad speech should be countered by more speech, not by banning the bad speech. They say that's the real antidote here, and we should allow for good faith disagreement without dire professional consequences. It's a very short letter. Honestly, we probably could have just read the whole thing, but listeners can go and can do that on their own if they want. What do you guys think? I'm assuming it sounds like we're all kind of on board with this to some extent, but is there anything in this that's wrong? Let's start with disagreements.
Sam, you want to hit lead off on this?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't be sure where to start in terms of disagreements. I tend to find myself more in line with the authors of the signatories of this letter that speech that is even repugnant is better countered than suppressed. So I'm not sure if I have a lot here meaningfully to disagree.
I mean, as a conservative, I'll push back a little bit about the will we expect this from the right line, but only a little bit because I'm sure it does happen, right? No doubt there are examples of that.
Yeah, Coyle, let me ask you about this. I mean, do you think that they have in mind some of the efforts we saw? I mean, I think in the 1980s, 1990s, when the Scorsese film version of Last Temptation of Christ hit theaters, when, you know, the boycott of Walden Books by Focus on the Family. I mean, things like this that, you know, I think of as phenomena of the 80s and 90s. I mean, I guess that's what I had in mind when I read that.
Yeah,
passage.
And I think it depends on how you're counting this. So I wasn't paying attention to politics in the 80s because, you know, that's when I was born. But I assume there weren't calls to get, you know, Scorsese fired and drummed out of Hollywood. Maybe there were because again I was, you know,
there were.
Okay, well there you
I mean,
go.
I was barely old enough to be aware of it, but I was aware of it.
Right. So my awareness basically picks up in the late 90s, early 2000s when you have and again filtered through talk radio for whatever that's worth. Certainly, there's disagreement from the right. Rush Limbaugh hated Bill Clinton. I don't think there's any doubt about that, and encouraged people to vote against him both in the impeachment and in the election. In terms of, you know, getting, you know, bureaucrats who politically disagree fired, that's where I'm like, well, I don't know that I necessarily remember that. And Sam, I guess you've been in practical politics. Maybe you have more experience with this than any of us do. Was this the sort of thing that you would expect to encounter sort of equally from both sides, or are the authors right that, you know, this is more a function of the right than anywhere else?
Okay, I'm going to generalize wildly.
Sure.
As I struggle to recall, my perception is that in the near term, let's say the last 20 years or so, the Republicans, and this is sort of like I would say part of partisan politics, would be much sooner to accuse Democrats, whether in policy or speech, of being un-American.
Sure.
I think we saw that. I think in the 2003-2004 presidential cycle, you saw that really begin to emerge as I shouldn't say beginning, but like that's when my political awareness of it was. Here, I think we're seeing something a bit different. This is a little bit different, whereas I'm going to read a sentence from the letter. Whatever the arguments around each particular incident, the result has been to steadily narrow the boundaries of what can be said without the threat of reprisal. So I think this might be different. We're seeing this is a really poor comparison, but if you think of like in George Orwell's 1984, the idea of newspeak coming in to restrict what could be said, the ideas that could be expressed. This is not a straight analog, but it's interesting to think that what we can say now perhaps has been narrowed, at least in the minds of some. And I think that is different. I think there's another thing that makes this noteworthy. You know, some people have referred to this in critique as illiberal liberalism. The idea that it is the left, largely, that is policing this new narrowing, and that historically has not been true, and for that reason, it is particularly of interest. And maybe it's all the more stark or all the more dissonant as we hear the chord played for those reasons.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues that makes this difficult to talk about is it has been the right that's been doing this rhetorically for far longer than the left, even accounting for the Marcuse essay and the effects of that. Again, talk radio and practical politicians, especially aggressively beginning in the early 90s, and then ramping up after September 11th, and then maybe really ramping up when Barack Obama becomes president. Right, that narrowing of the window in terms of rhetoric, right? What makes someone a true American? Well, somehow John Kerry, I love your example there, right? Somehow John Kerry was un-American, you know, even though he was, you know, Vietnam War veteran and long-term public servant and so on. Somehow he gets marked as un-American, and then we have Barack Obama, who his citizenship gets questioned. So I think the right is certainly guilty of that practical that rhetorical. And kind of public presentation narrowing. That's a good way to. I think you've got a good way to put it there. And then the question is, who's better at applying that, right? And at least this letter seems to say, hey, the left is getting in on that game too.
And this is also different because we have Twitter or whatever as the public square now. So it's not merely the elites. So you know, certainly there's prominent examples we could think of. This is you and me on Twitter, and we say something that is outside of the Overton window, and it impacts employment or whatnot. That's significant. I wonder, for the three of you who are in academia, is this something you think about in terms of what you put out there publicly forever in cyberspace?
Oh, good Lord, yes. Yes. even with, I don't know, Jordan and Nathan, do you guys have tenure in your institutions?
No, mine doesn't grant tenure.
Yeah, not here either.
Yeah, even with tenure, this episode will be carefully edited, and honestly probably filtered through two or three people before it goes live, and that's true of all of the episodes we post. So if at any point you guys say anything that makes you nervous, let me know and I will edit it out. Any other? Sorry, go ahead. Someone was Nathan. You were about to jump in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I mean, in my own case, I certainly do self-censor around progressives more than I do around conservatives. And it is for this reason. Now, that said, I do self-censor around what I would call right-wingers, because I think one phenomenon that the letter implies, or I think it implies either that or I'm invalidly inferring it, is the phenomenon of the right-wing online troll. I mean, which is it's analogous to what goes on, to force people out of jobs, because they have violated Overton windows or whatever, but it is a lot more arbitrary. It's a lot more personal. It's a lot more vicious, I would say, than even, what befalls people for, posting, memes that, offend, progressive sensibilities.
Right. Yeah. And again, I was trying to think of kind of practical examples of this, on the rights, and the right wing troll was certainly one of the examples I thought of, particularly from the alt right. And I mean, obviously, Nathan, you and I both teach at religious institutions that have doctrinal commitments. So there is some level of it's not self-censoring that I have to go into, because I, mostly agree with I teach at a Baptist institution, and I am a Baptist. But were I Roman Catholic, or were I, Eastern Orthodox or something like that, then presumably I would have to be more concerned with what I say publicly. But even accounting for that, I still think I wouldn't fear them as much as I would progressive Twitter.
Well, it's interesting. My good friends who are in state universities right now, and I mean, who tend to be center left in their politics, right? When I have conversations with them, I often find that they are self-censoring a lot more than I am on a day-to-day basis, because at least at my school in Coyle, you can speak to your own school. because of this new political environment where the policing is coming from progressive elements more than it is coming from right-wing elements, you know, my Christian college at least has really renewed its commitment to open exchange of ideas and things like that simply because, you know, it sees that as a need that has increased recently rather than, you know, something that is a threat anymore.
Yeah, and certainly I have colleagues here who came specifically so they could get away from those kinds of pressures, right? So they could express their Christian faith. That's almost always what I hear when I'm on committees. I wanted to be at a school where I could publicly and openly be a Christian and make comments about that while you know, in the classroom and not have to worry about what the possible repercussions would be.
Well, and it's interesting. The friend I have in mind most is an atheist center-left English professor.
Right.
And he's told me, you know, I can't wait till I make tenure of you and I can actually say what I think in department meetings.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've taught at a state school. I've never taught full-time or tenure track at a state school or anything like that. But even as an adjunct, and maybe that's not the best measure, because when I was an adjunct, I always felt like I can say what I want and I don't have to care because what are they going to do, demote me? I mean, it's, you know, you're at the bottom.
Take away your 10 grand a year.
Yeah. So it's like I can say whatever I want. But teaching at a public school, I never particularly felt any pressure to, you know, hide my conservative inclinations or faith or anything like that. But I also didn't hammer the students with them. I was like, yeah, this is what I think. If you disagree, I don't care. You're wrong, but so what? As long as you get the question right on the test, that's what matters. Anything else? Any other points of disagreement? Otherwise, I want to ask what you guys thought about this overall. We're coming up on an hour, so we should move towards wrapping this up.
I don't have we'll talk more about this more in a minute, I'm sure. I feel like the strongest stuff in the letter is the final paragraph.
Yeah.
I feel like the first two paragraphs are just kind of so much hemming and hawing and posterior covering, to put it politely. That's kind of what I see all the Donald Trump stuff, as being, is kind of like trying to present some kind of left of center bona fides before laying it out in the last paragraph, when I kind of wish they had just, you know, come out swinging. But I'm struck again, you know, kind of talking about the worlds which all of these controversies are playing out. There was a little bit of a resonance with me in that first paragraph talking about, you know, the legitimate claims of protesters, and again, in quotes, talking about greater equality and inclusion in places like higher ed, journalism, philanthropy, and the arts. And you know, you've got your sarcastic note in the show notes. Those are not the areas. Let me put it this way: those are the areas that op-ed writers at the New York Times care about. Op-ed writers who are never ever going to, you know, be visiting a Wendy's in the Atlanta suburbs late at night. If you get what I'm saying right there, Kevin Williamson, who, you know, is intentionally abrasive, but I think made a salient point here, is that, you know, burn down that Wendy's, George Floyd is still dead. You know, tear down that statue of Robert E. Lee, George Floyd is still dead. Create all the, you know, these new deans and committees at various Ivy League institutions, George Floyd is still dead. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a betrayal of the, I don't want to say myopia, that's maybe a little strong, but the kind of interests of the signatories of the letter as being, you know, upper middle to upper class, you know, coastal elites are betrayed by where they think they see the greatest needs for greater equality and inclusion there, with kind of lip service played to things like police reform, which again is not something a disagreement I have with the letter, but I think that is a weakness in it, is that because this is a letter signed by a whole bunch of writers and intellectuals, they are going to be primarily interested in the things writers and intellectuals are interested in. As much as I like some of what the letter has to say, I wish it had broader scope to make it clear that these ideas would benefit ordinary people on the ground, the people who are actually being affected by some of these bad policies.
I read it a little bit differently. When you see that second sentence, not least in higher education, journalism, philanthropy, and the arts, that yeah. seems to be the fields from where the signatories are coming. So this seems to be, hey, this is our world. This
gotcha.
Is what that's the way I read it.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. I should probably amend my irritation a little bit to that. I kind of wonder, though, if, you know, just even naming where they're coming from isn't kind of hiving them off a little bit from the people that they're expressing concern for. But I think that does make better sense of what they're saying.
I mean, if we read this to be more narrowly, this open letter to be not open to everyone, but hey, we're targeting our own institutions, then it probably makes greater sense that they would show their brand names for that reason. But I mean, this is obviously prompted greater discussion, which is good and useful.
Yeah.
And I think to your point, Jordan, I mean, that is a discussion that we all need to have.
Yeah.
I have the sarcastic comment in the show notes. Certainly higher education, journalism, philanthropy, and arts are going to be in agreement about racial and social justice issues kind of across the board. So in that sense, yeah, what a waste to spend your time calling on those places. But to spin this generously, maybe practically what they meant is, look, these are places where minorities are not represented far more so than in the working class. I mean, higher education administrators across the country are mostly white. And that's it's not a universal rule, but it's a pretty big rule. And same thing in journalism, same thing in philanthropy, same thing in the arts. So maybe there was some attempted intellectual kind of internal house cleaning there. That's the generous spin I can put on it. But I need
to be more generous. So
I do want to ask the mention of Donald Trump, which I think you're right. I think that's just sort of there as a throwaway. Hey, we're all really on the same side moment. I'm kind of curious what you guys' perspective on this is. And of the four of us, I think, Nathan, you're the only rabid Trump supporter. I think the rest of us are probably all on the other side.
But only up to WrestleMania 4. After that, he really went downhill.
what's your perception here? Has Donald Trump had a chilling effect on free speech? Is he part of this problem, or is this just the hey, we're positioning ourselves politically?
I think that there is a real sense in which he has emboldened the right wing troll that we mentioned earlier.
Sure.
I think that there was a fear that kind of thing would be regarded at least as social suicide, if not, you know, getting you into legal trouble before 2015 in a way that has lessened. So in other words, I mean, you know, wherever you draw the line between free speech and threat, I would say that I know I should use the phrase Overton window, but again, I'm from the 90s, so I always think of Living Single, and I think of the character Overton. But at any rate, I really do think that there is a genuine fear, especially for women on the internet, that, you know, voicing certain positions is going to invite right-wing trolls, including rape threats, death threats, those sorts of things, that has at the very least increased since 2015. So I do think that there is something to it rather than nothing to it.
No, that's fair. Any other thoughts on that specific Trump issue, not on Trump in general? We could talk about that all day.
Yeah, I wonder if there is a sort of licensing that happens when you see not only a person in authority, the president of the United States, but someone with whom one might agree politically, and you see him speaking, tweeting, whatever, in such disparaging ways that a sort of licensing effect happens where you feel like that is okay. Again, we're not to overuse the Overton window, but like those are okay bounds of speech on the internet. I mean, I think even for Christians, I've seen it's almost like license to disregard Ephesians 4:29 within a certain political context, and that's been surprising to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about my own social media, and this is all talking about social media, right? I mean, I I basically have little public speech other than that outside of, you know, outside of the classroom, I guess. And even that's only semi-public. Has the way I speak publicly changed either by expanding or being restricted since Donald Trump became president? And maybe it's just showing my privilege, but I think the answer is probably no, other than I talk a lot more about Donald Trump. So the substance of it has changed, but I don't know that the amount I speak has, and maybe that's because I'm not a woman, and I don't think I'm a right-wing troll, because, my God, that sounds exhausting. I cannot imagine the mindset that, like, makes you go around and hassle people on the internet, or in real life, for that matter. I mean, I also don't really understand going to a protest and screaming at the protesters.
Well, but also, Coyle, I mean, to be fair, I mean, you have convictions that transcend party loyalty.
Well, that's true.
And, I mean, the sense that I get is that the right-wing troll as a character, to, you know, to use the McIntyre term, because I can't do a podcast without mentioning McIntyre, but, you know, the character of the right-wing troll is one who will do and, you know, has done usually things that skirt the line of legally permissible and often crosses that line of legal permissibility in order to damage the other political party.
Right.
So, oh. I mean, you know, and I really do think that, you know, those folks are, I mean, you cannot appeal to a principle that transcends party because they don't have any. So therefore, the threat of legal consequences is what keeps them in check. And what we've seen is, I should expand that, legal and social consequences is what keeps them in check, right? So the fact that those social consequences have largely evaporated, the legal consequences have become a lot more tenuous, I think that really is a change. So, I mean, I get the sarcastic comment. I was amused by it. But I think that there is something, like I said, rather than nothing to that.
Right. No, and that's fair, I think. Although I will push back a little bit. I think the Trump supporters also have principles that go beyond party lines. They're just principles surrounding Donald Trump. I don't think they care about the Republican Party
I'm
at all.
Well, I'm treating Trump as the party.
Yeah, yeah.
He is no longer the conservative party. You and I both know that.
Sure, sure.
It is the Trumpist party.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens either in 4 months or in 4 years when there's no longer a Donald Trump to rally around what that looks like. Let's round out by talking about that last paragraph. Someone want to volunteer just to read that?
Hit it, Jordan.
Sure. Sarah praises my reading voice, so we'll see. This stifling atmosphere will ultimately harm the most vital causes of our time. The restriction of debate, whether by a repressive government or an intolerant society, invariably hurts those who lack power and makes everyone less capable of democratic participation. The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument, and persuasion, not by trying to silence or wish them away. We refuse any false choice between justice and freedom, which cannot exist without each other. As writers, we need a culture that leaves us room for experimentation, risk-taking, and even mistakes. We need to preserve the possibility of good faith disagreement without dire professional consequences. If we won't defend the very thing on which our work depends, we shouldn't expect the public or the state to defend it for us.
All right, I think I agree with you, Jordan. That's the best paragraph in the whole thing. What do we think about this? I mean, this is the libertarian view of speech, right? You counter bad speech with more speech. This is an explicit repudiation, again, of that older Marcusean idea of you shut down the people who are the most privileged in order to elevate the unprivileged. This is in some ways a shot at intersectionality, although they don't say that. I think some of the signers certainly wouldn't agree with it being phrased that way. What do we think? Is this a cure for what's ailing us in terms of our cancel culture?
Well, it sounds like the four of us are largely sort of in the same space. I'm thinking about this, so let me pose sort of try to frame the counter argument in a way in good
sure.
faith. Is there not speech that hurts and that creates significant adverse consequences that are destructive? And is the marketplace always equipped to handle them? What happens when we have speech that by its mere presence or engaging with it makes a dangerous idea more palatable. Like, you know, again, sort of expanding the Overton window.
Yeah, and particularly, how are we defining dangerous, right? What does that mean? So I think everyone, you know, however libertarian you are, and I don't know if any of us are libertarians on here, but however libertarian you are, all of us are going to say, Sam, you shouldn't give that "I'm going to punch you in the throat" speech, right? That is not something you should say to anyone. So physical threats, certainly. Where that gets into the gray area, should I be able to call for someone to get fired? Right. Should I be able to call for the termination of an employee who is a, you know, a member of the Nazi Party? Should I be able to call for the termination of someone who's a Klansman? Should I be able to? And we could go through, and then we could get even more narrow in our definition and say, well, if your speech makes someone feel bad, well, now we're beyond that kind of. There's some application in the physical world too. Does that speech get restrained, right? If it's an aggressive, emotionally aggressive statement, and now we're dealing with the right wing trolls, right? The internet trolls. Shouldn't just say right wing trolls. Left wingers can do that too. Everyone can be awful on the internet.
Equal opportunity.
Yeah. And then we could even get yet narrower and start talking microaggressions, right? Things that there is neither intent to cause harm. Nor knowledge that harm is being caused, and yet there is still the reception of harm, right? Is that the sort of thing that gets that gets counted? And again, the letter is very specific as far as saying no, we shouldn't be going into those sorts of things. But we can also see the argument for maybe being more restrictive there. Even if I don't agree with it, at the end of the day, we should be able to see why it is. Other thoughts?
I think this is a matter that does call for casuistry. I mean, you know, the if you think of two, you know, tendencies in the way that we order our public life, one is to legislate everything so thoroughly that no surprises ever emerge. And the other one is to legislate in broad principles and then trust to the people who are elected, appointed, and otherwise come to be authorities to exercise prudence in ordering the community, right? You know, my own tendency is towards the latter. I think that, you know, the conversations about, you know, just to use microaggressions as an example, you know, I don't think we gain much by saying that, you know, microaggressions are either universally a problem or universally not a problem. I'd rather look at it case by case and say, all right, when does it call for education? When does it call for moral reprimand? When does it call for, you know, a little bit of leniency, you know, based on cultural background and so on and so forth, right? I'd rather not have universal rules at the outset governing all of it, right? Now, I will say that, I mean, you know, I think that the libertarian principles that you pointed to, Coyle, I mean, you know, hark back to a text that the Christian Humanist podcast talked about a while ago, John Locke's Letter on Toleration. And what I like about it is that, you know, he calls for toleration not as an end in itself, but as a means, a necessary means to an end beyond itself, right? So, I mean, you know, too often toleration becomes, okay, you know, we're all just going to live perpetually at disagreement, even about the most important things. I like Locke's vision better because he says we should not inflict violence. And in his mind, it's the crown that's going to inflict the violence, right? But I think you could extend this argument to the Twitter mob, to whatever else, right? We should not inflict violence because in order for someone to make a free choice towards the good, that person actually has to have the freedom to choose the good, rather than being coerced into it. And in fact, they can become averse to what is good because it is coupled with repressive violence. And again, you know, in Locke's mind, I mean, that is, you know, Queen Elizabeth cutting off the hand of, yes, Mr. Stubbs. But by the way, I'm a terrible person because that story amuses me so much, but it does. You know, I think that, you know, when I think of the folks who in 2016 never would answer a poll that they were going to vote for Donald Trump, but then voted for Donald Trump. I mean, that's the dynamic that's going on, right? And again, you know, I don't think that they feared public disagreement. What they did fear was becoming a was suffering social consequences for something that they regarded as a valid disagreement, right? And for that reason, they weren't public about it. And then, you know, November 2016 rolls around, and all of a sudden, those invisible voters suddenly become visible, right? And I'm kind of wandering here, but I think that that principle of protecting that exchange of ideas, again, you know, within that framework of casuistry that I talked about, is something that right now the balance, if you will, is tipping away from it. And I think in this particular moment, we would do well to tip that balance back towards open exchange rather than towards, you know, protecting people from speech.
Yeah, and I think it's important to mention that at this point, what we're talking about is basically all social and cultural, you know, quote unquote laws. We're not so much talking about government regulation of speech.
That's too often the move that people make. They say, well, the First Amendment doesn't deal with this, and I say, yeah, it doesn't. But the principle that animates the First Amendment is something that we probably should consider here. Why is the First Amendment a good thing when it comes to the government? I mean, you know, is it because it's the government, or is it because it is repression?
Right. And Sam, you can correct me on this, since you're an attorney, and I assume you know this stuff a lot better than I do. But my understanding of the Fifth Amendment, right? If you plead the Fifth in court, right? Not only are you not testifying against yourself, but that can't be used against you, so that the jury can't say, "Well, you pled the Fifth, so we know you must be guilty." Right? They're not allowed to do that. It is to be a neutral statement that it protects you, but it doesn't do you any harm. So that's not the way our culture currently seems to treat certain kinds of speech, right? I suppose
violence is violence.
Yeah, yeah. Silence can be violence in certain circumstances. Whether it is in the circumstances in which it's been used lately, I don't know. That's a different question. That's one of those things that I have to carefully self-censor on. But should we have free speech protection such that whatever you say, again, within a fairly broad Overton window, right, within a kind of maximal Overton window, it doesn't cost you your job. It doesn't have major negative social ramifications. Maybe you lose some friends over it, but you don't lose your job. You don't lose your spot on the PTA. You don't lose whatever other things. Or should we have a sort of narrower cultural interpretation where there is some kind of policing that goes on, and maybe we just don't like the kind of policing it is? Well, again, the authors of this letter seem to be falling on the one side of that that says no, there should be fewer ramifications.
Let me interject with two reactions. One is just a very narrow one to the idea of silence is violence. I mean, on the other hand of that equation is often misattributed quotation that in the realm of all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do
sure.
nothing. And there certainly is an element there, but that is a very rich topic that I will go no further into. I've sort of lost the thread of my second thought, which was actually the crux of what you actually were talking about. I think it was in the vein of certainly freedom of speech, even outside of a constitutional context, is not a freedom from for people to react to that speech,
sure.
to oppose that speech, right? The harder question is, when should we punish speech? And then what punishes is certainly up to debate. When is it appropriate? When should we go to the individual, the speaker's employer, to report this to achieve an outcome that will be adverse to the speaker? That, I think, is sort of the crux of this debate. Well, maybe not the crux, but certainly one of the main points of it, in addition to limiting speech, which such would serve to do.
Yeah. So if you're the if you're working at Hobby Lobby, which they've recently changed some of their policies, so I shouldn't use this as an example, but if you're working at Hobby Lobby and you go down to the, you know, support transgendered and homosexual rights parade and march in that, should Hobby Lobby then be able to terminate your employment? And I mean, I'm kind of on the side that says no. Like I would say what you do when you're on your own time, I tend to favor the protection of speech more in that direction, even though I'm also in fan of, you know, property owner rights and so on, and if you own a business, you own a business. But the other side of that is maybe you don't get to wear your "I support all of those rights" shirt to work at Hobby Lobby. Right? There is still some limitations set on speech, and finding that exact cultural and social line, man, that's a challenge. Other thoughts on the letter? Otherwise, we should wrap things up.
Jordan, what do you got?
Oh, man. I was very interested to participate in this just to have some smarter people kind of, like, help direct my thoughts on it. So I am, like, just kind of swimming with lots and lots of stuff. Something that's...
I'm glad Sam was on the show, too, by the way.
Yeah. But two things that kind of occur to me here at the end. One is that... some years ago, and I've been, you know, guesting on these for 4 years, somewhere near the beginning of it, Danny on Sectarian Review had Nathan and I on for a discussion of political correctness. And one of the very, I don't remember much about that discussion, but one of the things that I felt it helped me understand was that what we used to call political correctness, which is now, you know, metastasized into wokeness, is kind of an attempt to make up for the collapse of kind of traditional unwritten social codes, various kinds of what we used to call common courtesy. The country is so large,
right,
and society is so complex and so diverse, you know, as the anti-federalists correctly predicted, it's gotten so big it's unmanageable. And so something is stepping into this gap to try to negotiate the unwritten boundaries that people just have to feel out between each other, and it's not doing a very good job. And what the second thing that this has all kind of put me in mind of, and David French actually has a piece at the Dispatch about this that I haven't read yet, but I would be very interested in his perspective on this, is the entire, you know, cancel culture, whatever you want to call it, as kind of a new species of irreligious fundamentalism. And a lot of these controversies remind me of nothing so much as the kind of controversies that I want to say Nathan mentioned earlier, which I grew up in a, you know, independent, fundamental, you know, fundamentalist Bible believing church that was all on our church sign by the highway. I remember the Walden Books thing. I remember the Kmart thing. I was kind of vaguely aware of the aftershocks of the Last Temptation of Christ, all of that. And I went to a fundamentalist Bible, well, not a Bible college, a university, and actually gave an anti-censorship speech for my persuasive speech in my freshman year of college, which was in 2002. And it met a mixed reception. And the some of what I, you know, as a very callow 18-year-old suggested, you know, about some of the consequences of regimes of censorship, I see the same warnings infinitely better expressed in the final paragraph of this this letter. Both of them responding, though, to objections that across that religious divide between fundamentalist Baptists and, you know, the irreligious woke crowd, I see lots and lots of parallels and resonances. Does that make any kind of sense?
It does.
Yeah.
And if I could just say one more thing, Coyle, yeah, and then we can wrap, is that, you know, I think what this controversy and, you know, the letter more particularly reminds me of is that, you know, there is a call to have a philosophy of human freedom, right? You know, the reason that John Locke, you know, objected to state censorship was that in order for real change in the soul to happen, it has to happen freely. And I think he's basically right about that. And I think that, you know, that is a consideration that entirely too few people consider when we're talking about these regimes, right? It's either let people be how they are forever, or it is people are going to be how they are forever, so crush them if they are the wrong way forever. And there's another possibility there, and that is that people might actually change their minds, change their souls, and we should create space for that to happen. That's my concern. And I think, we talked about, not a lot of positive objections, but if there's a negative objection I have to the letter, I think that's what it would be.
No, I think that's certainly something I agree with. And that's also probably a good place to stop because we are well over an hour at this point. So, guys, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm glad to have you all here. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/City of Man Podcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.